This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined by Professor Nigel Boyle. He is a professor at Pitzer College, a part of the Claremont Colleges in Southern California. And this past spring, he taught a course, one of the most popular courses in the history of Pitzer College, called History and Political Economy of World Soccer. Welcome to The People's Game, Nigel Boyle.
Thank you very much, Alan.
And indeed, this course is, in some respects, with Jennifer Doyle and myself, part of the inspiration for the show that we have here at The People's Game. Well, tell us a little bit about the course and what you were seeking to convey to the students at Pitzer College, how you came to teach a course on world soccer.
I'm a political scientist, and I co-taught it with an historian, Andre Wakefield. And we did this 4 years ago for the last World Cup, and then again now for this one. And the core idea is sort of using soccer as a prism to look at a variety of issues around the world, nationalism, racism, political economy, the organization of the game, a little bit on the financial aspects of the game. And so there's an awful lot of things you can look at through soccer. And so that's what we were trying to do in the class. Very much a survey class, so you could teach this exclusively on the economics of the game, on the sociology, on the anthropology. We kind of skipped through various of these fields and did it as kind of a survey to give students a sense of the different ways in which you can explain different aspects of the world and globalization through looking at the beautiful game.
And the response of the students at Pitzer?
Well, as you mentioned there, it was the most popular, I think it was the most popular class in the history of the Claremont Colleges, in fact. It was, and we capped it. We filled it with seniors and juniors. We could have had over 300 if we'd have let anyone in. I think we expected it to be popular, but not quite that popular. But some of the demographics, perhaps, at the Claremont Colleges will explain that. We, on the one hand, have a fairly high number of students who themselves come from immigrant backgrounds, Latino backgrounds, or whatever, whether it's this interest in soccer through the family. We also have a huge proportion of our students that go abroad for a semester a year, and so they go abroad and perhaps encounter a soccer culture elsewhere, and that triggers a lot of interest. So perhaps it's not a typical cross-section of young Americans, but the fact that there's been high ratings for soccer in this World Cup in the U.S. Didn't surprise us, because I think this has been building up, and that the class is another little piece of evidence for that.
Well, as I looked through the syllabus, and it's a 16-week course, I do, however, want to jump to week 14, because let's talk a little bit actually about this year's World Cup, and as it were, sort of reflected through the prism of your course. And so let's jump right to week 14. Your prelude to the course in week 14 was called On to South Africa, Cooper, Szymanski versus Pele. And it's the political economy of winning World Cups is the name of the one lecture, and the other is Pele's prediction in the 2010 World Cup. So what did you mean by Cooper, Szymanski versus Pele, and how does it then turn out, and what's been going on in the 2010 World Cup?
Well, Pele famously predicted that an African team would win the World Cup before the end of the 20th century. That obviously didn't come to pass. Cooper and Szymanski use a lot of economics and quantitative data to try and predict what sorts of countries are successful in World Cups. And one of the predictions that they make is that African teams will not succeed in World Cups. They point to large first world welfare states as having an inordinate advantage when it comes to winning in World Cups. Down the line, they predict that big countries such as the United States, Japan, China will eventually become global soccer powers. They also, along the way, are able to explain why England persistently does not do well in World Cups, despite expectations to the contrary in England. So the Cooper and Szymanski predictions in general are holding up fairly well in this World Cup. England bombed precisely as Simon Cooper in this work and other works have predicted. The African teams were doing poorly until Ghana caught fire, of course, and along with most soccer fans, I was bitterly disappointed to see them go out at the quarterfinal stage. But also, one of the arguments that Cooper and Szymanski make in that book is on the dominance since the 1970s of this continental European-style soccer that you could call Rhineland soccer, but the total football from Holland, Germany, Beckenbauer, and that era, which has become the global norm and increasingly played by Brazilians and Argentinians as well as Europeans. But the fact that Germany and Holland are thriving in this World Cup would tend to bear out what Cooper and Szymanski have been arguing. So I think most of their arguments hold up. I was desperately hoping that Ghana would disprove them on the African prediction.
And I understand that the students in your course made some predictions.
Yeah, at the very end of the last class, we sort of pulled out the different groupings and then did a vox pop, a set of predictions on who was going to win each game. And we took a photograph of it at the end, and it's pretty remarkable, including predictions that involve, you know, the U.S. finishing top of its group and then losing to Ghana and all of this. So the class actually came up with Spain, Holland, Germany, and Ghana as the four semifinalists. And of course, we're one penalty miss away from that being a perfect prediction at the semifinal level.
Right, save for the canny Mr. Suarez's hands of the devil.
Yes, indeed. So this is not my personal prediction. I would have probably had the Argentinians going all the distance. This was the collective view taken by the class. But
let's actually unpack this a little bit further. First question is how did the class, it is really almost unthinkable that a class of undergraduates at Pitzer would be polled, basically, and end up not with Brazil among the semifinalists. That was because they looked at the brackets and felt the Dutch would beat them somehow?
Yes. My colleague, Andre Wakefield, is a very big Holland fan, so he would have perhaps prompted them in that direction. But yes, we have Holland beating Brazil. And so Andre was very keen on Holland's strengths got through this. I was saying more about the Germans' strengths. So
you saw Germany's strengths in advance of this tournament because obviously they were, especially when they lost Balak, but even before that, they, you know, in 2002 they were considered so very weak, and on the strength of Oliver Kahn, but also a very cohesive side, they made it all the way to the finals, and in fact they didn't give up a goal against Brazil until Kahn made a rather bad play.
Right.
And then in 2008, they weren't considered very strong in the Euros, and they reached the finals. So, you know, this sort of perpetual undervaluation of the German side going to the tournament seems to be a trend in them overachieving. Of course, in 2006, they delighted all of Germany and almost beat the eventual world champions in the semifinals.
Except I actually think this is a different sort of Germany. In the past, as you point out there, some quite ordinary German teams have gone all the way to the final. So the durability of the Germans, even when, so that 2002 team, it had Balak and Kahn, but that was pretty much it. And whereas this team is something that's grown out of some fundamental reforms that were carried out by the DFB in Germany after a couple of very poor performances at World Cups and European Championships, to build a better cohort, a stronger cohort of top soccer players. And so they completely overhauled the youth training system. And this happily for the Germans coincided with the change in the citizenship law in Germany, which meant that Germany could start tapping into the kids that were born to immigrant populations. And so you have the Mesut Özils and Khediras and Boatengs now represented on the national team. But they've gone to great lengths to strengthen player development, and they've really left the rest of Europe behind in this regard. And so this team that's now doing so well in this World Cup is the team that won the under 21 championships last summer.
Right.
I saw some of those championships, including the final game, where they absolutely played England off the park. And
right.
So them beating England in this World Cup was no surprise to anybody that had witnessed that. And it shouldn't have been a surprise to the English as well. We had a guest speaker come to the class, John McDermott, who's actually the head of the Tottenham Hotspur Academy. He wrote a technical report on the under-21 final where England were destroyed by Germany for the English Football Association. But I don't know if anyone didn't read it or Fabio Capello didn't read it, but clearly they failed to anticipate how well this cohort of young players, shorn of people like Balak, really played some really wonderful soccer. I mean, the speed, the team play, this is, in my opinion, Germany are the only team that have really played great soccer in this World Cup so far.
Yeah, they're a very interesting side to look at the results so far in this tournament. First of all, in some respects, maybe they were a little lucky for the defeat by Serbia, because I think it kept the spotlight off of them, and they, in many respects, the blowout of Australia then was looked at as something of an aberration because they had only had 10 men in the second half, and Germany couldn't beat Serbia, couldn't even hold for a draw once they were down to 10 men. And I think that meant people weren't as intimidated as they really needed to be of this side. I also have to say, though, the quarterfinal result against Argentina makes England look not so wretched in retrospect as well. I mean, after all, England at least had the offensive potency. If you look at Argentina, they really never even challenged the goal in the entire quarterfinal match. So England maybe can feel a little bit less miserable about themselves. But as you point out again, they simply don't have in England anything like the young players and development that the Germans seem to have in abundance at this point.
I'm disinclined to let the English off the hook. I think the England team are truly terrible. I think the Argentinian team that were beaten today are a team of wonderful players who, when they went behind, had no tactical capacity to come back. Whereas I think the dearth of talent on the England team is of a different order. And it may make the English feel a little happier that Germany now looks so strong in other games. But I think English soccer is in crisis, and they need to learn the lessons that the Germans learned about 8 or 10 years ago and to really do something about it in terms of player development.
But looking at Germany as well and honing in on them as they prepare for the semifinals, just the importance of these young players is amplified by the fact that we're 2 years removed from Germany playing Spain in the finals of the European Championship, where Spain were the prohibitive favorites and the worthy victors of the tournament and of the match. Going into this match, I think the Spanish have to really consider that they're facing a different side.
Yes, very much so. Although this should be the classic game at this World Cup, though, because Spain do play this wonderful short passing game, and now they're going to be up against a team that play a much more rapid form of counter-attacking game. So this is the makings of a classic contest between two teams that really like to attack as well.
And there are airs, though, in some respects, though, of still the 70s total football that came out of the Bundesliga, but also maybe authorship primarily belongs to the Dutch. And and you have Cruyff bringing this game down to Barcelona.
Exactly.
And while the nature of the play has evolved somewhat, but, I mean, their defense is their ball possession and is their constant attack. And it should be an incredibly intriguing matchup. So taking an even broader view of the 2010 World Cup, what do you see of this tournament and about this tournament? And let me remind listeners that I'm speaking to Nigel Boyle. He is a professor of political studies at Pitzer College in the Claremont Colleges here in Southern California. And he taught, along with Andre Wakefield, the history and political economy of world soccer this past spring at Pitzer. So what are the primary observations you can make about the 2010 World Cup through the themes that you looked at in your course? I'm interested in even reflections maybe about what the 2010 World Cup, its spectacular popularity around the globe and success, says about maybe where we are in this sort of phase of global capitalist crisis, what it says about nativisms and nationalisms and anti-racisms as well across society, and after, let's focus on that, and then I want to talk about the game in the United States, which has also been a big theme on this show.
Right. So, as you say, that the sort of global reach of the game and the extent to which it has been so popular, you know, in places like the United States, Japan, Latin America, and Europe, of course, that's very striking. In terms of the games themselves, frankly, a very disappointing aspect of this World Cup to me is the ability of some teams to just negate. I think some of the smaller European teams have discovered that through superior organization, they can prevent the other teams playing. And so I don't think this World Cup will be remembered as a great World Cup in terms of the quality of the play and marking a shift in the way in which the game is played. So I don't think it'll rank with the 1954 World Cup, where, you know, total football emerged, or even the 1998 World Cup with Zidane and the French that year. So that part of it has been a little disappointing. Obviously, what's distinctive about this World Cup is that this is the first World Cup in Africa, and that's where I still haven't recovered from the tragedy of Ghana losing to Uruguay there. So it would have been wonderful to see an African team at least reach the semi-finals. But clearly, the extent to which the whole continent of Africa appeared to rally around Ghana points to the special significance of soccer in Africa. So, again, I think that this is a World Cup which has demonstrated soccer's sort of global reach at a new level. Even if the soccer itself hasn't been dramatically improved or different.
But it does seem almost every day of the tournament, with only a few exceptions, starting at maybe the second round of first-round games, even maybe beginning with Spain's defeat by Switzerland, every day was highly dramatic. A tremendous amount of highly, but again, not necessarily because there was gorgeous flowing football. In fact, sometimes it was because the Italians were so flat, for instance.
Yeah. What bothered me, even with the top teams, is, and this is where the Dutch victory over Brazil is interesting, there haven't been these games where teams go behind and then come back and where the game sort of shifts and where you have two teams that appear capable of coming from behind, so that the first goal has become all important in these games. And so once that is scored, then it becomes this tactical battle. And one of the sort of bigger theme that we touched on in the course concerns that the nature of the game itself as compared to other games.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike the American sports, for example, you can't tailorize soccer. The coach cannot micromanage the game. So this soccer historically has had is a game where the players on the field are really shaping the flow of the game. And so, and to some extent, in this World Cup, I think that the tyranny of coaches has become extended, and you have teams playing to a pattern where individual virtuosity does not count as strongly, which is another reason why it was very disappointing to see Ghana go out, because there was just sort of novelty and virtuosity displayed there by the Ghanaians, which has been in short supply when you look elsewhere.
Well, part of the sadness of that, of course, too, is it's really exacerbated by the fact that Suarez was having a beautiful tournament, and now he's not going to play against the Netherlands, which is a compounded issue in terms of drama, because he was probably the top player in the domestic league in Holland this past year.
That's right.
And then it looks like some of their other really top performers on their side will be out. But I thought that they've been tailored, as it were, quite well by their structure to allow Forlan a great degree of creativity. And to some extent, Forlan is the player of the tournament, or one of the top two or three players of the tournament so far. And, of course, Uruguay coming back to make a semifinals, you know, should be a great historical story, but it is, of course, completely overwhelmed. And again, it's not just disappointing because Ghana's not playing in the semifinals, which would be so exciting and so exhilarating for the fact that there would basically be the home side up against one of the tournament favorites, but also because Uruguay is going to be very weakened without maybe their second, third, and fourth best players.
So it's
really not as compelling as it would have been otherwise. But again, there's been so many surprises in this tournament. Who knows? I actually wanted to try to hone in on this one question and see if you have any reflections on it about, okay, the World Cup is the most popular cultural event in the world. Okay. I don't think that's arguable. I don't think there's ever been a World Cup that's ever been any more popular than this one or followed more closely. It seems to get bigger with each successive 4 years. And I think that's in marked contrast, say, to the Olympics. But what do you think that might mean in 2010, in an era where, you know, global financial capitalism is in severe crisis? It's just waves of crisis hit. Now, this week, it looks like the U.S. labor market and U.S. consumer spending is, Paul Krugman says, we could be going into a depression. There are not meaningful left populist humanist movements to come up with alternatives to the capitalist model we have, and the whole world is mesmerized by a soccer tournament.
Yes, and you have a government like the government in Germany that's in crisis, but there you have Angela Merkel dancing on the podium as Germany triumphs. Although until the quarterfinals, the story of the World Cup was the success of the Latin American team.
Right.
And, of course, in Latin America, you do have less populist governments in power everywhere except Colombia in South America. And this is true for Uruguay as well, of course, who are still there. But I was half looking forward to Brazil versus Argentina in the final and seeing Lula and possibly Chavez and others showing up to
right.
sit alongside Mandela.
Chavez, and then they'd invite Castro and Maradona. With,
Of course. And I read the story that Chavez was actually involved in Maradona being made coach of Argentina in the first place as well. So left politics in Latin America is strongly connected there, with Argentina. Yes, of course, the World Cup is this great global distraction, but
at the same time, that's the thing, is it's a paradox. I mean, it does bring all the world together. I think, and then to sort of turn the frame onto the United States, you know, when Glenn Beck on Fox News is railing against the World Cup, calling it socialist, unmanly, un-American, I think he has legitimate fears there. I mean, you know, he's advocating for a type of, put the border fence up nativism, keep the rest of the world out, and the entry of global soccer into the United States marketplace like never before creates bonds of solidarity between the American people and all the other people in the world and this source of incredible joy. But at the same time, of course, it's all sponsored by McDonald's, Coca-Cola, Nike, Adidas, et cetera.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings on this, on the corporate sponsorship, because you've probably seen that awful car ad that features the Redcoats lining up with Dodge ad against the George Washington mm-hmm. Driving in to confront the Redcoats. And it's, you know, two things America got right, cars and freedom, which is the sort of nonsense that you hear in beer adverts and the like. But I kind of like the idea that corporate America is actually getting in on soccer nationalism and that they actually want it to be involved in cultivating this, because it is a different sort of game, because it is so global, that the U.S. is dominant in the American sports, which have this strong parochial appeal. But when you see the sort of nationalism that was starting to form around the U.S. team as they went through this tournament, there was something quite impressive about it, that the U.S. does not need to be exceptional in order to be good, to be successful. And that's a more attractive message. And in the course, we talked obviously a lot about nationalism and nationalism, the nationalism that revolved mm-hmm. around national soccer teams. And there's a very ugly history to this in many parts of the world. But I think Eduardo Galeano is an author we use quite a bit in the course. And he was very good at pointing out how two-sided soccer can be in the hands of dictators, in the hands of other actors. Very often that you can have quite progressive forms of national identity that form around a soccer team. And I think Germany is perhaps the best contemporary example there. This is a new Germany. This mm-hmm. is a multicultural Germany. And I think in 2006, Klinsmann accomplished something along those lines, and, you know, turning the Germans into the party Germans. And this team, if it carries on doing as well as it has done thus far, I mean, this will dramatically change German perceptions of German national identity. It's hard not to be ambivalent when confronting these sorts of issues, because it can take on different forms.
So here we are. We're at the semifinals of the 2010 World Cup. We have three of the four teams that your class predicted would make it to the semifinals. So, Kay, everybody out there in the world should listen extra close. Who did your class predict would make the finals?
They predicted that it would be Holland against Spain. They predicted that Holland would win.
Holland, of course, that seems like that would be the betting odds. I'm guessing that Germany against Spain is going to probably have a pretty even betting line at this point.
If they're going on current form, I think that they would probably have Germany as favorites by now. But that will be very difficult to predict that one.
I've been speaking with Nigel Boyle. He is a professor at Pitzer College, and he taught this past spring the history and political economy of world soccer, along with Professor Andre Wakefield. Nigel Boyle, thank you so much for joining us on a show, The People's Game, which your work has been an inspiration for.
Thank you very much, Alan.
Everyone's feeling pretty. It's hot Thursday in July. Though the world's full of problems, they couldn't touch us even if they tried. From the park, I hear rhythms.